Hey, good morning. This is Michael Gibbons talking from Carson City. I'm the Chief Judge of the Nevada Court of Appeals. This is the time set for oral argument. I'm joined with Judge Jerry Tao in Las Vegas and Judge Bonnie Bulla in Las Vegas. We have four cases to be argued today. The first one is Francis Johnson versus Mike Byrne and the Department of Corrections. I see Mr. Olson is here. This case was originally set for June. It was continued at Mr. Olson's request, which of course there's no problem. There have been a lot of unusual things happening this year. We're continuing on with the video arguments because of the pandemic conditions. I haven't traveled to Las Vegas since the beginning of March, you know, when this started. I would much prefer to be there in person and have everybody else in person, but this seems to be working okay. We've done a number of arguments this way. We've also had a couple problems, so if there is a problem where we lose a connection, then we'll try to regain it by video, and if we can't do it by video, we will do it by telephone. Hopefully we won't have that that concern. I see Mr. Tadre, too. Can you hear us all right?
Yes, Your Honor, I can hear both courtrooms.
Okay, great. All right, Mr. Olson, do you want to reserve any time for rebuttal for your argument?
Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes, please.
Okay, thank you. And we appreciate, again, you taking this case through the pro bono program. I know you've taken a lot of cases. It's always good to see you here.
Thank you, Your Honor. It's good to be here. Okay.
All right, you may proceed then.
May it please the court, Eric Olson, appearing pro bono for the appellant Francis Johnson. The district court in this case dismissed Mr. Johnson's complaint because he did not conduct a 16.1 conference with the Attorney General's office. But the court abused, in the appellant's view, its discretion to do so by failing to provide an analysis of the factors described in Kipp versus Alexander. Mr. Johnson is an inmate currently at the High Desert Correctional Facility in Indian Springs. He commenced this action in May of 2017, pursuant to NRS 410322 and USC 1983 against the department and former assistant warden, Mr. Byrne. At the time, he was an inmate at Ely State Prison, so he commenced the action in White Pine County. Johnson's case was dismissed as a result of a third motion to dismiss, this one filed by the Corrections Department and Byrne, even though the Corrections Department had actually been dismissed from the case 8 days earlier. And the court dismissed on the single ground that Mr. Johnson had failed to conduct the 16.1 conference within 180 days after September 25th. 2017. That time ran on March 26th, 2018. Just 10 days later, on April 5th, the respondents filed their third motion to dismiss.
Now, so, Mr. Olson, let me ask you a structural problem. You're saying that the district court abused its discretion because it didn't procedurally do what it was supposed to do, but the KIPP factors to which you refer are highly factual. And normally, when you have a discovery problem or some sort of rule of civil procedure problem, like in this case, you have two attorneys. The attorneys missed a deadline. The attorneys, you know, come in there with this, the excuse is usually something like, you know, there's improper service. My paralegal screwed it up. I was on vacation. I was sick. I was in the hospital with COVID, something like that. But as officers of the court, they're making factual representations to the court that the court sort of weighs. But here you have a guy who's not an attorney. He's a pro se guy. And then you add in he's an inmate. So in a discovery type motion like this, how does the court get to the bottom of the facts in this case? Because like I said, you know, normally you would just listen to the attorneys. The attorneys have duties as officer of the court, but one party isn't an officer of the court here, and he's an inmate.
Well, Your Honor, that puts, frankly, an even greater burden on the appellant in this case. He is an inmate. He's not only a pro se party, and pro se parties are supposed to follow the rules, but he has the further limitations of being within the prison walls. You have, the court can look at the procedural, the history of the case. And the court can also look at, as it did, the one thing it did look at clearly was the affidavit of Mr. Johnson as to his situation being limited in his access to the legal library. The court's determination on that single fact is kind of strange. The court suggests that because, the district court suggests that because Mr. Johnson was able to get out some other later pleadings, that his representation or his statement that he didn't have access to the law libraries should have be rejected. That really isn't a logical conclusion. The filing the court points to is at the end of April 2017. These events took place earlier, and so simply rejecting Mr. Johnson's affidavit that he was denied access to the law library after December 2017 doesn't really make any logical sense. The court could have, and did not, looked at, first of all, accepted that, could have looked at the history of the case, could have looked just simply the difficulties of a pro se person and an inmate in conducting a case. And frankly, and I mentioned this in the briefs, I think it's worth noting that even though the Attorney General's office did not have a specific duty to remind Mr. Johnson or conduct a meet and confer, it certainly did not do so. And I think that in the rules to suggest, well, it certainly be better and more consistent with the rules for the parties to work together. That's implied in the rules, and certainly if there were lawyers, they would do so, rather than what happened here, which is simply waiting for Mr. Johnson to make a mistake and then file a motion.
Mr. Olson?
Yes.
Is there any documentation in the record, any evidence, affidavit support, that gives us specifically the time frame in which Mr. Johnson did not have access to the law library, the prison law library?
Not documentation per se, Your Honor. There's the statements of Mr. Johnson, and there are two different statements. One indicating he did not have access after September 2017, and another saying December. I think I interpret that to mean that he was transferred in September and was denied access until at least December of 2017. And frankly, it's, I think, a credit to him that he managed to get pleadings that he did get out, handwritten primarily in some sort of cogent way. The district court did mention or suggest that the pleadings are replete with citations, but honestly, if you read the pleadings, they're sort of repetitive and not very substantive, but he was able to, at points in the litigation, put out product that was at least cogent, as I said, and stated his positions.
Mr. Olson, can you explain or give us an idea of why lack of access to the prison library would constitute a compelling and extraordinary factor that the district court should have considered in this case?
Well, Your Honor, I don't want to overemphasize. Yes, I will say that there's just some inherent difficulty, and the compelling circumstances include the very fact that Mr. Johnson is incarcerated. In White Pine County, at least at this time, and I think probably to date, there is not electronic filing. There's some logistical difficulty in communicating with the court, getting things filed. I think that is increased by the fact that Mr. Johnson's incarcerated, can't go back and forth to the courthouse. Although there is a burden, the same burden placed upon pro se litigants, I think it's everyone can. Should be able to agree that Mr. Johnson is not similarly situated even to a pro se litigant. There, even the language about the responsibility for conducting a 16.1, it specifically refers to plaintiff's counsel. So there is, just by virtue of the fact that he's incarcerated, that he doesn't have the ability to access pleadings as we would have, certainly in this district, and kind of figure out what has happened in the case. For example, you know, he clearly, Mr. Johnson from the record, was confused about what motions were granted and who remained in the case. There was a seven-month span between the filing of the first motion on behalf of the Department of Corrections and the decision. In the meantime, there was a second motion filed on behalf of Mr. Byrne, which I think, frankly, was not well taken because it was a motion to dismiss for lack of his proper service, yet Mr. Byrne clearly knew he'd been served by the sheriff. The sheriff's affidavit is in the record. So there are these things that were certainly confusing in looking back at the record to me, and would have been very difficult for anyone, particularly someone incarcerated, to determine. And then
what you're talking about isn't a problem with the library. What you're talking about now is a problem with the fact that he's not a lawyer. It doesn't really have a lot to do with his having access or not having access to the library per se. Right?
Well, it's not just. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Go ahead.
It's not just not being a lawyer. It's being where he is and not being able to get to the library inhibits him from trying to figure out as best he can 16.1, the rules on dismissal, to try to get an idea of what's going on by doing some research, like I said, into the rules and perhaps into the case law. So it's part of a difficult situation, extraordinary, I would say, circumstances for a litigant, and just a piece of it. The law library is a piece. It's the sole piece that the court considered, but it isn't the sole piece of these circumstances, which I would say are extraordinary and make it very difficult for someone to litigate a case which he's entitled to litigate. You know, one of the things that strikes me about this is part of it is an access to justice issue. And I realize that Mr. Johnson is incarcerated, but that's not supposed to make a difference. Not anywhere in the rules. And so if he doesn't have that access and he is unwittingly doing something that is not in strict compliance with the rules, even in his circumstances, it just strikes me that that's an unfair situation. And there's no undue delay. The court didn't look at these other factors, but we did the analysis in the briefs, and there's no undue delay. If there's any undue delay, it's likely from the motion practice that occurred.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you. I just want to make sure, did Mr. Johnson have or not have access to the legal library at High Desert, the place he was transferred to?
At a point he did, but not initially.
Okay, and we don't know exactly when that point was that he had access.
What we do know, pardon me, what we do know is he says the only evidence is he did not have it up to December 2017. Those are the facts we know.
Up to December 2017?
Correct.
Okay.
Up to or starting?
Well, starting, I believe it was limited. He was transferred, I think, I may have misspoken. September 2017, I believe, is when he was transferred. And once he got there, December 17, he was denied, according to his affidavit, access to law library. Clearly at a point, and the court makes this notation, the district court, by April 28th, he seemed to have access. However, the court also appears to assume that because he had access then, that he'd gotten access at some point earlier, and that's not in the evidence, certainly.
Thank you, Mr. Olson, for the clarification.
All right. I see that I'm running.
running low on rest of the time then, 2 minutes and 15 seconds for Mr. Olson for a rebuttal.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, Mr. Tadra, you may go ahead. And like usual, we like to hear a little more from the Attorney General's office about how this system works, because, you know, you deal with it every day. We don't. And what's different about this case than the typical lack of access we hear is that he was transferred from one prison to another. And what is the significance of that? I mean, shouldn't be a controlling factor, but maybe it is. I mean, I don't know what's going on. I mean, what this means when somebody is transferred and their ability to access a law library because of a transfer.
Of course, Your Honor. May it please the court. This is Senior Deputy Frank Todrick II for the Nevada Department of Corrections and its employees. It's excellent again to be here, even as here remains virtual. We'd like to thank the court for taking the time to move this hearing a couple times to deal with the logistics of COVID and Mr. Olson and my schedule. And lastly, we'd like to thank Mr. Olson for taking this case pro bono. It's been excellent to work with him. But I'll take Your Honor's question a little bit out of order first, as that's the factual query that this could turn on. First, while Mr. Johnson was at Ely State Prison, it's unclear if you meant to say that he didn't have access there or not, but anytime that an inmate is at Ely State Prison, they're still working on the paging system. So generally, there's still not going to be a physical access to the law library there, but it's going to be requests through law clerk, prison workers, porters, or COs to get documentation from that law library. That system has been challenged a couple times and been upheld numerous times. When he was transferred down to High Desert, while I don't have the housing records aren't exactly on the docket, he would be transferred, and then, as if it occurs between any institution, he'll go through an intake period, generally no longer than a week, just to make sure he's going to be classified at the right place, and then he'll go into his housing situation. At that point, it'll be like nothing has happened, and he should have full rights of whatever housing assignment he has. I would note, if he was in some matter of protective segregation situation or a medical situation, he still might need to page for access for documents in the library. But by and large, the High Desert Law Library is going to be mainly physical access, and especially when this case happened, 2016-2017, I don't think they were really operating much of a paging system. So essentially, as soon as he got placed into his more permanent housing situation in High Desert, he should have had the ability to send in a kite or inmate request form to be able
to get there. Is that because Ely's high security and High Desert is lower security?
Yes, Your Honor. It's a staffing and a high security issue. During that time in 2016 or 2017, Ely was still in a only maximum security situation. So for that reason, they were not having in-person law library access. High Desert has classifications of all sorts, protective segregation, general population, what have you, and they switch almost yearly due to their size and capacity needs.
Okay. All right, so Mr. Tadre, you're indicating the general policy is that if you're transferred, there's only a short time where one would be held incommunicado, and after that you would either have personal access or through a kite. And in this case, though, the individual, Mr. Johnson, claims that he did not have access. He repeats it through all of his pleadings, and then he claims he got access in April. And so it just seems strange that you would have nothing, then all of a sudden you have everything. Yet, looking at the pleadings, I don't see where the Attorney General's office contested his allegation. In other words, he's made it, maybe inartfully, but he's made it. And I don't see a response where the AG says, no, this is not accurate. So are we left with just accepting his representation that he didn't have access?
Well, Your Honor, the District Court, Judge Fairman, did address this in regarding the motion for clarification, where he stated it was still replete with references to law citations and statutes. But I would also note that if we go back a little bit, the opposition itself would set forth that he does have access to law library. He was able to make copies of all his grievances in order to oppose the exhibit. I mean, to oppose the motion, the third motion to dismiss. Therefore, the only place he could have got any kind of copies was from the law library. They don't have, even though High Desert's a larger prison, there's not copy work or printers that are in each of the housing units. So in order to just have his exhibits, that means he had to have had at least some matter of access to the law library to get these copies. Next, if you really wanted to submit that he was being rejected time, this is something that's very easily provable, as he would have always had access to his own inmate records to show that he was hiding or requesting time to go to the law library, and he could have easily received documents to evidence the same. I can't quite suggest why my predecessor did not squarely address that, but perhaps any lack of evidence of Kite's requesting the same. Each of those High Desert units should have a weekly visit, sometimes biweekly or twice a week, to the law library. But I'll carry on a little bit beyond that. Going just past that his exhibits had to come from the library, the Court of Appeals has since, or it was actually a partial panel of the Nevada Supreme Court, while unpublished, has addressed an issue where an inmate claimed that due to access, he was unaware that a 16.1 early case conference deadline was pending or had passed. The matter, and this was addressed, this was actually brought up in the reply brief. Now, the matter is unpublished, but Mazzoni v. Berry, number 63149, in September 16, 2014, directly addressed this issue, that if the inmate prisoner is claiming he was unaware or had no opportunity to learn about the 180-day rule, that it was still not an abuse of discretion to dismiss a case for failing to meet that deadline. The panel on that, in that case, recognized it's not an abuse of discretion, even if the plaintiff may not be aware of the ECC deadlines.
Right. So, Mr. Tawdry, I think the issue is, and we see this repeatedly, is that when these inmates file lawsuits, the state responds with a motion to dismiss. Sometimes these are handled timely, and other times they sit there for months, and in some cases for years before they're resolved. And are inmates supposed to go forward with the 16-1 conference, even though multiple motions to dismiss are pending? And then in this case, there was an issue about who the parties were based upon the various motions. So is that different than in this case you're referring to from 2014?
Yes, Your Honor. There's a couple of differences here. First, we're not dealing with a timeline that's triggered by the vagaries of what counts as a first appearance. There's been cases before this court where an answer was never filed, but a timeline was triggered by what is, quote, a first appearance. We don't have to get into those vagaries because the deputy AG never used any of those motion to dismiss appearances as a launching point. The filing of an answer, however, does set forth an unambiguous launching point that should have given him 180 days. I believe it was October 2017 that the answer was filed. Thus, the 180-day deadline should not have been ambiguous to him. It should be directly to March 27th.
I certainly agree with you. The rule changed. It's a lot clearer now. The answer, the time period is running on the 180 days. There's absolutely no doubt about it. So the question is, though, is it any different if you have a motion to dismiss pending, or in this case, multiple motions? And what about the district court? Is the court supposed to look at its own delay in under the Dornbach case in deciding this, or apply the Kip v. Arnold factors when making the decision? I mean, that's what's really at issue here, if the court did any of that.
The court does have the option under Dornbach to perhaps order a meet and confer if it believed that any of the delay was caused by its own mechanisms. It does not appear, while there was overlapping motions to dismiss, It was also based upon on motions getting filed after request for submission. The seventh JD is still on, was, and is still on the request for submission doc. So they, so that court would not have had the option to even put anything on calendar. I would say that if, under Dornbach, if they believed that in, if any of the wounds were self-inflicted, as it were, they would have had the right to set a meet and confer to tell counsel, hey, talk to Mr. Johnson, set something up, get a deadline. But I would say that given the hard deadline that sprung from the answer, it did not believe it to be necessary. And I would say the motions to dismiss would have, the various motions to dismiss would have weighed heavier in the event that the Deputy AG would have tried to use the initial appearance as a time to use its timeliness motion to dismiss.
Well, Mr. Todra, in 2016, the rule was changed that you had to conduct the early case conference 30 days after service of the complaint. So we're really looking at the service date, which I think is pretty much in line with what the dates that everyone's been looking at. Having said this, would you agree that Mr. Johnson did not have his full 30 days to conduct the early case conference before he was transferred from Ely to High Desert Prison?
From Ely to High Desert Prison?
Right, during his transfer. Or before his transfer, he did not have the full 30 days to conduct the early case conference. Would you agree with that?
Well, I would set, let me think about that timeline. Well, I can at least speak to the custom and function of how the early case conferences were set around that time with Ely prisoners. Given the exceptionally rural location of it and that their opposing counsel was either going to be in Reno / Carson or Las Vegas, the form and custom with Ely prisoners had always, and indeed almost all Nevada inmates, had been simply to set a letter to the Attorney General's office saying, we need to have a conference at some point because it would be illogical or impossible for them to set an in-person conference as counsel would do. As in that regard, whether he was being transferred, whether he was having law library access, it's very much something he can do to just send a letter to the Attorney General's office. And further, if we're going to submit that perhaps the 30-day rule should have given him an additional time period, even after learning the rules on the motion to dismiss, he still made no attempt to cure the deficiencies. He didn't say in his opposition, well, I was prejudiced because of this, we can set the time now. He never attempted to make an individual case conference report, which regardless of the ECC service deadline is another mandatory deadline that he made no attempt to hit. So yeah, he had the opportunity within the 30 days, even without quote unquote law library access, to just send this letter to his opposing counsel. I don't know if there's any other communication between them, but he certainly always had the 100 address the entire time.
I'm so sorry.
All right. I think what Judge Bullo was saying is during the 30-day time period, the transfer occurred. So therefore, was the time told because he was being transferred? And you said at the outset that everybody, when they're transferred, goes through a period where they have no communication when they arrive at the new facility. So he didn't have 30 days then. So that would have kicked in the additional time periods. Is that what you were saying, Judge Bullo?
Yes.
Yeah. Hang on. I don't think he said that during the transfer process there's no communication. He's just not assigned yet.
Correct. He's going through. He'll be 1 or 2 days in transport, then maybe a day in intake, and then he should be within his unit within a week. So at most, there's 5 days during this 180-day period that he's not in his regular routine. And the motion to dismiss was filed 190 days after. So even if we're adding those 5 days, even if we're tolling it, which there's no case law saying that you have to toll when somebody's moving, he still wouldn't be delayed. And this still
But Mr. Tawdry, I heard you address the Dornbach case. I didn't hear you answer regarding the Kip v. Arnold. I mean, is the court supposed to apply those factors before dismissing?
No. And this has been actually square on addressed. I believe it was Dornbach itself that's, well, Kip itself states it's a non-exhaustive list of factors. But in Dornbach as well, it states that there need not be a factor-by-factor analysis. And while it certainly could have been a bit more full-throated, as it were, there is no requirement for a one-by-one-by-one-by-one analysis.
Right, but isn't the court at least supposed to acknowledge the case here? The district court didn't even mention it.
The case that, okay, there's two cases that set forth that they need not make the factor by factor. That's going to be McGuarin versus HJD 65625 and then Dornbach. But the specific query was addressed in Dornbach that they need not make a consideration by each list. But even if it's not full-throated, this district court opinion did actually quote every singular factor before and stated that they weighed in the factor of the state. So maybe not as detailed as we could have hoped. There was an allusion to every single factor in KIPP, even though Dornbach states it's not necessary.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Tawdry.
Thank you for your time.
All right, Ms.
All right, we hit my mute button.
You get the clock reset. Mr. Olson, hold on a minute. Okay, sure. Looks like we're ready to go.
I don't know what the protocols are in the prisons because that's not in the evidence. That is not something, the assurances of Mr. Tawdry, as accurate as they may be, are not evidence, and we can't know from that what happened with Mr. Johnson. It is true the AG made no challenge to Mr. Johnson's declaration or affidavit. I did one thing that I thought was interesting is I don't know what Mr. Tawdry was talking about. Letters get sent to the AG's office from the prison for setting 16.1s. I don't know who does that. Maybe this wasn't on Mr. Johnson. Maybe it's a procedural matter for the prison. I don't know that. I also don't want the court to completely lose sight, though, even if the KIPP factors don't absolutely have to be applied, that they ought to be considered when terminating sanctions are in place. And this court may have said KIPP existed, but it did make no finding except for this single finding on what I'd call the good cause factor. It didn't consider, other than saying 180 days had passed, it didn't consider the time frame. It didn't consider the fact that there hadn't been any substantial delay in the case. In fact, the Attorney General's office mentioned that specifically when it sought to extend after the fact a deadline for filing a reply. It is also not mentioned by the court in the opinion that the any scheduling or anything the court had tried to do to manage this case was disregarded or offended by Mr. Johnson's delay. So I think if you look at all of these other factors, including, as I mentioned, factors that are not expressed, but go to the issue of compelling and extraordinary circumstances. Now, I will leave the court with that, but I would ask the court not to just focus solely on the issue of access, although the evidence seems to be that he was denied that access.
All right, thank you, Mr. Olson. Then case number 76304-COA, Johnson v. State. Department of Corrections shall be taken under submission by the court for a written decision in the near future. We really appreciate the presentations by both counsel. You certainly provided information and argument that's helpful to the court in resolving this case. And even though it's been going on for quite a while, we still eventually got it done with this process. And we look forward to seeing both of you again. I hope, Mr. Olson, the pro bono experience has been rewarding for you, so you'll continue on with the program.
It has been, Your Honor.
And Mr. Tadre, you always do a great job on these cases, and you, like anybody else that does appellate work, is left with the record that's given to you by whomever worked on the case before. So that presents additional challenges, but again, great job. We really appreciate the efforts of both of you. Judge Tower, Judge Bullitt, do you have anything else you would like to say before we recess?
I just want to, you know, second what Chief Judge Gibbons said. Thank you, Mr. Olson, for agreeing to take this case. I know that you've had, I can't remember how many, but you've had more than one pro bono case in front of us. I've seen your name floating around, and we've had arguments before. And I know that's a major sacrifice of time by you, but we really appreciate it. As you know, in the system, there's more people than there are lawyers, more people in need of lawyers than there are lawyers willing to step up. And the fact that you're willing to step up more than once is really phenomenal, and really appreciate it so much.
I would just echo my colleagues, and I apologize. One of the difficulties with the video conferencing is sometimes we talk over each other. So I apologize to both of you if I did that inadvertently, but I really appreciated arguments on both sides and taking the time to help us understand the case from each perspective was very helpful. Thank you all so much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, we will be in recess.